Sunday night edition of the pod. Going to get started again with our young player progress reports for the season in the Western Conference. Going to do Golden State and the Clippers here to start off, and then Liam will come on at the end to do the Lakers. Get to some news in between those. So why don't we start with those Golden State Warriors. Now 55-21, a mere 2-4 since the last 15-60, had some home losses in part due to guys being out, in part due to Kevin Durant getting ejected on Thursday. Their 8.3 net rating is still second in the NBA. They sport the second ranked offense and the seventh ranked defense. They've clinched the playoffs and are projected with 58 wins and are nearly certain to be, I think they actually probably have clinched now.
They have locked in. Yeah. And to take care of a little bit of business before, because it's good to do with the Warrior, with a lot of these teams, when we're not, a lot of their business isn't about the young guys. Durant, with the two technical ejection against the Bucks, now has 14. That is two away from the suspension line. Granted, the Warriors have already clinched their seed, so it's not big in terms of that, but it's worth keeping an eye on. Now the three non-Curry All-Stars are back. Klay Thompson returned from his fractured hand on Saturday, and then Durant and Draymond Green came back on Thursday. So, it is really, to a point, a getting right physically stretch for the Warriors, because they don't really, if they want to, I guess they could theoretically impact the playoff race for the teams they still have to play, but I don't think they care that much about it until maybe like the last day or two of the season.
Yeah, and I think there are clearly preferences that should be emerging for them. The Clippers, the Spurs, the Nuggets, if they were to make it, maybe Minnesota if Jimmy Butler doesn't come back, New Orleans, and then Utah, OKC, Portland, you think are probably the ones that they would want to avoid in the first round. Minnesota, if Jimmy Butler comes back, obviously could be an issue for them also. But let's get to their young guys right now. It has been an unexpected season for a lot of these Warriors young guys, both for good and for bad. But let's start with the good 23-year-old Jordan Bell.
Bell has had a more successful season, I think, than a lot of people anticipated, even though he was highly praised as a draft pick, getting acquired for cash considerations on draft night last year. 18.4 PER, 65% true shooting, and 13.6 usage, which is on the low side, obviously, in about 750 minutes. Would be more if he had been physically capable, but in the second half of the year, he's been dealing with a lot of lower body injuries, and so that has kind of limited it. His space in the rotation has been variable, partially due to the just sheer multitude of big men that the Warriors have, and partially due to his own health concerns. Right now, Bell has played 34% of his minutes at power forward and 66% at center per cleaning the glass.
And for Bell, the skills have been better than anticipated. He's flashed a little bit of a mid-range jumper, though, on a team that's this high-powered, not one that you wanted to take. But his finishing, even on non-dunks, has been impressive. Then he is able to get up for those alley-oops as well offensively. He's flashed some nice passing, although there's also some tentativeness at times as well. But when he gets the ball in a short roll, he's able to make a decent decision a lot of the time. Does turn it over a fair amount. That's going to be, as a low-usage guy, sets screens, is a guy who's asked to make decisions sometimes off the pick and roll. It's not surprising that he has this 19.4% turnover percentage. That's something that you would expect to improve it in future years. And really, for Bell, I mean, you mentioned 34% at power forward. He's, not a non-shooter, but he doesn't have any kind of three-point range. So clearly, that's not the best use of his talents at power forward. What is the best use of his talents is at center as a switch guy. And we saw even going back to the first game of the year, he got torched by James Harden initially off of switches, then actually was able to hold his own later in games. But because of all the injuries that the Warriors have had, and just because he's kind of getting jacked around a little bit by Steve Kerr, who's, trying to teach him to play harder, and because they also have all these centers that they don't want to piss off, and Kerr just likes to play everyone, we haven't seen very much of him just playing at center as that kind of speed center, the James Michael McAdoo memorial role, if you will, but actually good. He did start both Cleveland games, so I think there's a hope, if he can get healthy again and if all the rest of these guys can get healthy, that maybe he will play some center, maybe even start at center against some of these teams that go to a more spread-based attack.
Long term, there are legitimate questions about what Bell's optimal role is within this Warriors team, because while teams have moved away from playing groundbound centers all the time they do play them is most often at the start of games. So how they want to use Bell is very, very interesting, because maybe he's better playing starters minutes, but not necessarily starting, or getting getting into that, and the Warriors will have to figure that out. Also, it will be determined, as it was this year, by who is on their team. You know, does David West retire? Does Pachulia come back? All those sorts of things. And so I think he's definitely a part of their rotation moving forward, but what part, what size is still up in the air. And this was his age 23. This is his age 23 season, because Bell, you know, played those years at Oregon. So kind of want to figure it out. And he only has one more year under contract before becoming a restricted free agent. So have to see where this goes. But absolutely, unambiguously, a positive year for him.
Yeah, he's a little light in the shorts, I think, to play against some of the biggest centers. And the switching, I think part of why they go more conventionally at the start of games is, you know, over the course of a long season, like, why do you want to subject all these guys to, like, getting beaten up in the post more than they really have to, some of their small guys to switch with? So I think we'll see more of Bell during the playoffs. I'm very interested to see how he does, because he does make a fair amount of mistakes. It's just a question of whether he actually can overcome that with his activity. You could see him getting into foul trouble, and also the injury concerns, where he's gotten these. I think all three of the injuries that he's had now, sprained ankles, have been on very aggressive block attempts. And so is he going to have to curtail the way he plays a little bit? That is a question. Patrick McCaw, who we thought was going to mature into like a 20-minute game role for this team this season, has had one of the more disappointing seasons in the entire NBA.
Yeah, there was an idea of where that McCaw could fit in as either the long-term replacement for Sean Livingston, kind of ancillary playmaker on the second unit, versatile defender, or even the ambitious one was kind of replacing Iguodala, even though he's more of a guard defender than a wing defender. And there are a couple big problems with that. One, McCaw's defense this year has not been as good as anticipated. He's had some better games recently and playing more with Curry's absence. But the far bigger part is that McCaw's lost his confidence as a jump shooter, and his three-point attempt rate is way down. He's all the way down to 24% from three, and he doesn't have to do a lot. There's other actually parallels to this with Bell. Like, he doesn't have to do a lot offensively, but he has to do those things confidently, actively, and convert them well enough to stay on the floor so that opponents defend them.
And he's got 74 points on 108 jump shots this year. That's absolutely horrible. 0.69 points per possession. And the three, as you mentioned, has not gone down. I think the few times that it seems like he makes one is when it's late clock and he's open and he just knows that he has to shoot it, because you can tell it's in his head. He's sort of like, it's not just, oh, I'm open, I'm going to shoot it. It's, all right, I guess I'm open, I have to shoot it. You know, it really seems like that at this point for him. And he had shot the ball really well at times last year. It does not look like a natural shooter, but I do think that maybe his shooting struggles really got to the rest of his game as well. We've seen him turn it over more. He still does have a lot of skills, long arms, good anticipation defensively, although I think we haven't seen as much of that either, getting into the passing lanes the way he did last year. You mentioned the defense, and it really, it's not a question of making mistakes so much as it's just he's not staying in front of guys. He has Thon Maker disease, where last year, you know, it seemed like he actually was able to stay in front of guys. He played some great defense on Damian Lillard at times last year, wasn't able to stop Kyrie Irving at all. And then it hasn't been until very recently, and he's also been derailed with that sprained wrist, but it's really on either side of that, or I guess broken wrist, on either side of that injury, it's been ugly for him. So with him going into Arenas free agency, maybe that was in his head a little bit as well, but he clearly reeks of a player right now who's lost confidence. And then obviously that scary injury that he had yesterday, thank God it sounds like he's gonna be okay, is not helping things either.
Yeah, it looked terrifying, and I have extended thoughts on this on Twitter if you want to see him. The injury has been it's classified now a day later as a low lumbar spine contusion, which I've actually never heard as described as an injury, but it makes sense. You know, it's just a contusion on your spine. But fortunately, x-ray, CT scan, MRI, the preliminary thing is that all of them are clear. He's of course going to have to deal with talk to specialists and all that kind of stuff, because they want to be very cautious with this. But I mean, we'll see where it goes from here. I mean, I had thought that there was this idea that, okay, well, it's all on Nick Young now, but you know, we'll see. And the Warriors will be, as they've been basically this entire year, very patient, especially with support players and just getting them back. And you know, it was scary. You never know if something like that is going to affect a guy moving forward, but it was such a weird random play that the optimist would say that it won't, just because the odds of that happening aren't any, you know, it's not any more likely in the future than the freakishness it was then.
22-year-old Damian Jones, a guy who we posited maybe they should have not picked up his third year option. I think that is looking prescient right now because he has not been able to make an impact at the big league level. He's in his NBA career, obviously got off to a tough start with that torn pec muscle that he suffered doing a bench press test working out for a team before the 2016 draft. But overall, he's played 19 games over two seasons, only 123 minutes, 38 this year, and is only 4 of 6 from the field. When he has gotten out there, he's looked extremely jumpy, does not appear to have acquired much better of a feel. In the G League, he has been effective there, 70% true shooting, and hitting his free throws pretty well too. He's improved that up to 70% from 50% in the G League last year. 20 PER, not doing as much on the offensive glass. You'd hope that he could dominate there. Only 9% offensive rebounds and still below a 20% usage. Does block a ton of shots though, 6% block rate. But that's just really, I don't see him as having a ton of feel either for finishing around the rim. I mean, he can get up for alley-oops in space, but when he's got a body on him, it's not amazing at the NBA level. But I guess when he's only taken 6 shots at shot attempts, you can't focus in on that too much. He hasn't looked great in summer league either, and clearly has been passed by Jordan Bell. So you wonder if his future in the organization is in question. You could see us, but him being a guy who gets traded away with like their second round pick or something like that, just as a way to save luxury tax next year.
And there could be teams that see him basically, Jones at the minimum, as a worthy flyer for next season. I would guess that they would want to make a read, you know, at summer league or something like that, because the fourth year option is always worth meaningfully more, still not a ton, than a third year option. But Jones played a couple years at Vanderbilt, so he's not super young, and he is physically capable, but you don't see this like crazy high ceiling on that end. So Myers in the front office are going to have to figure, I think they should be proactive with Jones, and I don't think they can plan right now for him to be more than the kind of the extra guy in the center rotation. And the Warriors will probably play 3 centers, like that'll be their ideal moving forward. Bell probably gets one of those spots, maybe Looney gets one, but if Jones is in that fourth spot, it's useful, and that's the optimist's version of where he is. And considering how valuable even a minimum contract is for them, because the players the Warriors can get for it, I would expect them to try to move him if possible.
Let's move to Quinn Cook, who we certainly wouldn't have expected to be discussing in this space when he was signed to a two-way contract this season. And Cook has been now started 11 games and played 471 minutes, and he's been awesome. I mean, better than really could have been expected. He's going to start in the playoffs. He's going to be a key guy, maybe even after Steph Curry returns. He's not going to continue to play this well. 42% on threes, 27 out of 64, and not the easiest shots in the world either, you know, since he's had to be relied on more offensively. And then what's really been buoying him is 21 out of 41 on long two-pointers. And then his floater game has been awesome as well, 18 out of 30. So he really, 55% on all twos outside the restricted area will not sustain. At the rim, he has struggled, does not have the explosion really to finish there, does not want to get all the way to the rim, really prefers to pull up. And he is a good mid-range shooter. I think he's a good three-point shooter. He's shown that as a scorer, and I think it's been good for him to settle in and have some confidence, know that his role is to shoot the ball as it was in the G League, and he can be effective. I mean, not as Steph Curry, but at least as someone who needs to be guarded at the point guard position, which is not something that they really have. And I think defensively, he's been, you know, I'd say he's been about average at the point guard position, which is not bad. So, I mean, to get a guy who can make shots the way he has and play average defense on your two-way contract, and a guy who's 24, great find for the Warriors.
Cook will be a restricted free agent this offseason, but we still don't know but we don't know what his tender is going to be, because he can be tendered either at the two-way contract level if they don't make him playoff eligible, which I expect.
They could just sign him to agree with him on a minimum contract that has money for next year.
Sure, as a part of it they could, yeah. But his two-way contract was a one-year deal, right. So they can't convert him into that. They could instead come to some sort of understanding. They could certainly do that if they want to, and that might be in play. I expect whatever happens will happen on the last day of the season, though of course the conversations can happen before that. But so if they kept Cook as a two-way player, he would be tendered at the two-way contract, which would be very good for their own flexibility. If they bring him up, he'll be tendered at basically at the minimum, you know, be that's yeah. The way it pretty much works for guys right around
and
now.
He's got to get so, brought up. I mean, there's no option not to at this point.
Well, with Curry, I mean, at this point, with it, with what sounds like Curry's going to miss some or all of the first round of the playoffs, I mean, you have to. And Cook has been, I think it's been intriguing how good a fit he's been after Durant and Green got back, because it was always unrealistic that he was going to have the ball in his hands as much as, you know, being the not only the Curry replacement, but just the offensive linchpin when so many guys were out.
Oh,
but
God, yeah, let's never speak of those games again. I mean, some of those games, like, I mean, that game against the Pacers, when it was just like, that was like some of the worst offense I've seen this year. And it's not his fault. I mean, he's doing what he can with this game. It's him and Nick Young, like, as the main offensive options, not good.
But Cook has fit in well as kind of an off-ball one, and he can shoot, catch and shoot, makes other teams defend, and the defense has kind of come and gone a little bit, but I would say average, what you said is fair. And so that's a useful piece for the Warriors, and it's also extremely important because that is not what Sean Livingston does. Livingston, capable player, versatile defensively, can pass, but doesn't shoot from other than, you know, his mid-ranger, and doesn't make opponents defend him out there. So Cook is a different type of player, and that difference could be important for them, not only as a Curry replacement, but in certain lineups, because they have so much more playmaking at the forward spots than most teams, the Warriors can make that work for them.
Kevon Looney, who had his fourth year rookie option declined, but so he will be an unrestricted free agent, maybe someone that the Warriors would want to bring back. He's shuttled between power forward and center, played mostly as a center though this year until very recently, when they've had issues with the wing depth and had to play him at the four. In better shape this year, you know, that was his big problem last year. I think he's gotten to starting to work more. He has a lot of intelligence defensively, remains a really good rebounder on both ends, great hands, great length, does not have a ton of explosion. He can switch some, but not really against the best guys. He's going to get torn up against some of the best guys on other teams if he's got a switch, and also not really strong enough to defend in the post against a lot of teams either. He's basically Jordan Bell, does a lot of the things that he does better, other than that Looney probably executes it a little bit better. The skill development wise, the mid-range jumper seems to have come around when they've now needed him to shoot a little bit more, although that's only 8 out of 15. He's looked confident shooting from there. The hope was that he could become a three-point shooter. That really has not evolved for him, and then he doesn't really have much post game or ability to score in the floater zone. He's only 6 out of 23 from that area. And as a finisher around the rim, you know, I would say he's maybe slightly below average. You know, he's got the length. He'll try to go up and dunk aggressively, but he can get bumped off of his spot, and he doesn't have the greatest explosion in the world. So he's below the average for the Warriors as a shooter at the rim this season. Anything you wanted to add on him before we move on?
Briefly, Looney's best traits are his effort and his kind of aggressiveness in the opportunities that are presented to him. Like, if he can roll hard to the rim and catch it and try to dunk it, you know, he doesn't try to do more than he can, other than a couple of mid-range shots right now, because the Warriors need that. And it's useful. I think of him more as a regular season player than a playoff guy, but I think Steve Kerr disagrees with me. So I think he's going to play more in the playoffs than I would agree with. And they can bring him back. But one thing to mention with this, as we will in the offseason previews for some teams, since the Warriors declined Looney's option, they cannot pay him more than that declined option, which I think off the top of my head is like $2.3 million for next season.
I will get to the Clippers momentarily. Of course, we still have the Lakers to come as well, and some news. First, though, this from MeUndies, which is the most comfortable underwear that I've ever owned. They're made from a sustainably sourced, naturally soft fabric that is 3 times softer than cotton, and I totally agree. They move with you. They never ride up. You forget that you have them on. You never have to make any of these adjustments that with other underwear you find yourself having to make. And you have to take my word for it, because MeUndies is so sure you will love their underwear. They offer a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you don't love your first pair, you can get a full refund, and that first pair will cost you 20% less, because my listeners can go to the link meundies.com/capspace, easy to remember, /capspace, because we talk about capspace all the time here on the program, and you can get 20% off, free shipping, and of course that 100% satisfaction guarantee to get the best and softest underwear you'll ever own. And for me, it's not even about how soft it is, although that's certainly awesome. The fit is just fantastic. It really does move with you in a very comfortable way. Once again, meundies.com/capspace is that URL. Start wearing the best underwear of your life. MeUndies.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us. Where do the LA Clippers stand these days?
The Clippers are 41-35, 4-3 since the last 15-60, 15th in net rating, slight positive, positive plus 0.9, 7th in offense, 18th in defense, and despite having a projected win total of 45, 538 projects gives them a 30% chance of making the playoffs, partially because 5 of their 6 remaining games are against still competitive teams, so that's just a lot.
And by the way, we're recording this before their game today, Sunday morning, so we're a little bit out of date, but so be it.
Yeah, they play the Pacers in a little while. And on the injury front, they're, you know, good, some good and some bad. The good news is that Danilo Gallinari is back. He played 25 minutes on Friday and has no minutes limit in their game on Sunday against the Pacers. But Milos Teodosic has a tear in his plantar fascia. He will be reevaluated in 2 weeks, which is after the end of the regular season, and is out indefinitely.
Yeah, and we talked with Milos about how sometimes it's better to just get that tear and have it heal. You know, he's had multiple absences with that plantar fascia, which now finally he tore after a spectacular first half a couple of days ago. The main young guy for them is Montrezl Harrell, who will be a restricted free agent this offseason, coming off being selected in the second round 3 years ago. And for Harrell, we talked about him extensively on the last 15 and 60, so we don't need to spend quite as much time on him, but he'd always looked pretty good in terms of the numbers, efficient scoring. It looks pretty good in the box score stats, but I've been impressed by his ability to attack in short areas, catching the ball on the move at the free throw line, faking the DHO, getting to the rim, and then being able to finish there. The jump shot hasn't really come around. I think if we were talking about him being a three-point shooter, you know, that's probably not going to be in the offing. But he definitely, especially on second units, comes in and just plays harder and with more force than a lot of these teams are expecting. The big thing that I worry about with him, though, to become a starter, which I'm not really sure is in the offing for him, is that the rebounding just isn't good enough.
The Clippers this year have not rebounded well when Harrell's been on the floor. They're 8th percentile overall in his minutes and 6th percentile when Harrell plays center, which is tough. And yes, you can make the argument that when Harrell plays center, there isn't a lot of supporting rebounding talent out there. But second units, you know, if you're having a guy who's a rebounder, then they're probably going to have other limitations if they're not good enough to start. So I'm a little bit worried there. I'm also a little worried because he's done a decent job. Opponents aren't shooting well at the rim this year, but this year is kind of the outlier right now relative to his 2 years on the Rockets. So if Harrell's less of a deterrent overall, then that combined with the defensive rebounding is concerned. But as a backup center, his capability is intriguing, and Harrell has not been good enough to generate a big offer sheet or anything like that. So it might be a circumstance where you'd love for him to be a little bit bigger in terms of his significance, but he's not going to be paid like that in all likelihood.
Piggybacking on what you were talking about with the percentage a lot at the rim, while they do shoot much worse there when he is on the floor, they take far more shots at the rim. Opponents take 5% more of their shots at the rim than when Harrell is off the floor. And granted, part of that is because DeAndre Jordan still has some effect as an intimidator, but he's also played a lot of minutes at power forward as well. And maybe on bench units, you can get away with having not quite as much spacing. I mentioned the jump shot. He hasn't taken a three all year and has only taken 12 twos outside the paint. I think he's hitting 25% on those. We've talked about it before. I think that he will be looking at kind of backup center money, which I think will be less than it has been before. Hopefully if teams wise up at least. But, you know, something along the years of like 3 years, $9 million, 3 years, $12 million, you know, that's what I think would end up being about right for him in restricted free agency. We'll see, you know, and that's to re-sign with the Clippers. You know, if he gets an offer sheet, which I don't expect, but maybe could happen, then it, you know, you'd imagine it'd probably be larger than that if they're actually hoping to get him. Sam Decker, another one of the guys who's been a massive disappointment. We thought that he could take a step forward. He'd shot the ball well, at least at times last season as a off the bench small ball four, but the big problem is he's shooting only 17% from three and only on 60 attempts. And despite the fact that they've desperately needed forward depth all year with Danilo Gallinari being out, Blake Griffin being out when he was on the team, he just has not really been able to deliver to Doc Rivers' satisfaction. And he's played 817 minutes. I'm surprised it's that much even, because it seems like he hasn't played any of the games that I've been watching.
It kicked up a little bit it kicked up a little bit for a period of time. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy how it happens with Decker, where it's just like, oh, you just sit there and go, oh yeah, like he's on this team, because Wes Johnson basically completely got past him in the rotation. Yeah, and a lot of those minutes came in December. In December, he played about 20 minutes a game and then fell out of the rotation again.
And that's when they were getting killed too. I mean, part due to the injuries, of course, but that's when we were like, oh, these guys are totally out of it. You know, they're 15 and 22 or whatever it was, or 15 and 20. Can't remember what. Maybe no, they're like 8 and 15 or something like that, I think. And then I was conflating them with the Jazz at one
and
point.
And when Blake got hurt around Christmas, yeah. And then they played well when he was out, and then they did better and got back in the mix. And they still could make it, but it'll be tough. So yeah, Decker, 11 PER this year, 5.26 true shooting. I hope for so much more from him. And at a certain point, especially since he's not a rookie and they're playing other guys who it's not like they're super established. This is not a young guy getting buried for a reliable veteran necessarily. That's concerning to be sure.
Yeah, like Tyrone Wallace has been playing at the three. Like they played CJ Williams over him
Williams
for a while.
Back.
I mean, they really are very convinced that he is not adequate.
Yeah, so you could think about the Chris Paul trade in a lot of different ways, but they got less value from Decker than we expected, but I would say more value from Montrezl Harrell, which has been a big part of their success this year. But we can move on to second round.
One more thing on Decker. I mean, I think he shows is it's just really hard to evaluate guys that you look at as kind of 3-and-D guys because, you know, you just don't know. The shooting could wane, but it's only 60 attempts, but maybe that's enough that, you know, Doc Rivers doesn't trust him now. And then, you know, the defense has, you thought that maybe he could get there, but it hasn't really been particularly impressive to be a plus on that end. He still can get to the rim. He still has a nice knack for finishing. But I mean, just quickly, what do you think of his career at this point? He's about to turn 24 in a couple of months.
I think that given the general scarcity at the forward positions...
You wanted to say dearth, didn't you?
I wanted to say dearth, but I didn't. and that is... So that goes really in Decker's favor. I still see physical potential. I mean, going back to Summer League, he sometimes he gets underrated as an athlete because he's white. I think that's fair to say. But it's not like he's unbelievable or he moves his feet super well. It's just that he can get up for dunks and things like that, and has since he was at Wisconsin. But I just don't see enough to give him more than a flyer. And a flyer is fine. You know, there will be forwards that are at his level that will keep getting those for eons because everybody's looking for it in the worst way. But Decker's going to have to prove a whole hell of a lot more than he has this year for me to give him any more than just a shot.
All right, who were you going to transition to after this?
Well, the Clippers took two guys in the second round in 2017. Juwan Evans, 21-year-old point guard, and Sindarius Thornwell, 23-year-old swingman, more of a two in my opinion. And neither one of them has been particularly impressive this year. Evans has played about 800 minutes, 7.2 PER, 28% from three on 54 attempts, and also 46% at the rim and 27% from long two. And those long twos are 22% of his shots, which is not great. Every once in a while, Evans makes a pass that I enjoy, and he can, at moments, his intensity defensively can be good, but I would not pencil him in as a backup one next year on a team that wants to be competitive.
The thing that's most striking to me is the unwillingness to shoot the three ball. Teams go under on him. He's just not looking to take that shot. He's not shooting a great percentage, but he's played a fair number of minutes, and only 54 attempts is very low. So, and you mentioned then he's not finishing at the rim either. In part, maybe that's because teams are laying off of him. As you said, I mean, he can get penetration every once in a while. He can make a few passes. He'll try to get into guys defensively, but he's undersized and is not really like just totally making guys uncomfortable. And the numbers are real ugly. You know, a lot of these rookies, you know, the really bad true shooting coupled with really low usage is not going to be great. So yeah, I agree with you. I mean, he hasn't shown anything to indicate that he's on a path to being a rotation player. Sindarius Thornwell has come around to some degree with the shooting. The most impressive thing for him is he's actually fourth among shooting guards in defensive RPM at 2.01. The defense, I thought he was really bad early in the season. I mean, there's a game when they played the Warriors when he just kept losing Steph Curry. I thought he was being brought in as a defensive replacement and just making a lot of mistakes and just losing guys. But that has waned, and he's been a lot better. I thought that he did a really nice job on Dame Lillard, for example, in that game they ended up losing at home to the Blazers. He gets into guys. He likes to get out full court, deny out on the wings once they give it up, and make them really have to work to beat him. And he's got solid strength. Unfortunately, the defense and the man-to-man defense specifically, as I haven't seen him be as impactful as a help defender, That's about where the positive ends for him this season.
His usage is below 12%, which is jarring, and his turnover rate is 16% almost. And Thornwell, the question is kind of, can he do the basic things? Can he be a 3-and-D player? And I liked him at South Carolina in a couple of games I saw, just because he got into guys defensively. And it's kind of remarkable that a player can have an 8 PER despite taking, the main shots he takes are threes, and he's shooting 34% from there. But that's what happens when you basically don't take that many shots. And 52% at the rim. That's not exactly where I'd want it to be. But again, it's a small sample size with everything else. And he does take 40% of his shots from there, but he doesn't take any shots.
Yeah, we'll see if the three ball comes around for him a little bit. He's just not really athletic enough to go by anybody, not really athletic enough to finish the rim. He's one of these strong college guards who's able to carve out space and score at that level, but really can't do that against NBA competition. We should also talk about Tyron Wallace quickly. Started 13 of the 23 games that he's played. He's now back with the big club after that contract dispute, wanting to move into being on a actual NBA contract, but the Clippers wanted to lock him into a longer term deal with some non-guarantees that wasn't as favorable. So he looks like maybe if they make the playoffs, they might convert him. If not, they had him just sitting down at the G League for a while, but now that the G League season is over, he's returned. And with Gallo back, maybe they don't need him as much. Wallace, a very interesting player, has improved his quickness and handle getting to the rim, which is good because he just basically never ever shoots on jump shots. He is 7 out of 25 from 3, has actually hit the corner 3, 5 out of 14, so only 2 of 11 above the break. Really does not want to take that shot at all. Does take mid-range jumpers a little bit more, but most of that is floater range, where he's been reasonably effective at 41%. He's only 1 out of 9 on 2s outside the paint, so really just a total non-shooter. But he has been effective driving on closeouts. Nonetheless, he can kind of, if he has some space, he can get ahead of steam, and I've really been impressed with his finishing at the rim as well as his defensive versatility. So definitely a guy who's an NBA player and is able to bring some athleticism, some ball handling from the three position. He's going to be a tough fit as a starter because you need more shooting around him, but when he's playing next to like a Teodosic and a Lou Williams, he actually has been a solid fit for this team.
Quickly, you'd feel much more comfortable with him as a rotation player next season, or even whatever season, than Sam Dekker at this point, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think that's very clear. They're pretty close in age. Decker's a little bit older. I mean, Dekker just in theory fits a little bit more, but especially Wallace as a transition player, defensively he's been a lot better than Dekker. He makes guys uncomfortable, pretty solid passer as well when he's able to drive, helps with the offensive pace, and maybe his teams really back off and don't guard him. That could change a little bit, since he probably wasn't at the top of the scouting report at any point. But no, I think I really liked what I've seen with him. He adds some athleticism and energy to the team, and plays it as, other than the fact that he doesn't have the mid-ranger, kind of like a proto Sean Livingston type of guy. Sean is one of the best post-up guards that's been around in a while, but, and I don't know that Wallace is ever going to get to that because he can't even hit a mid-ranger. But if you imagine Sean Livingston without that mid-ranger, like, that's kind of where he's at right now, I would say. Let's turn out of some news, and where we need to start, of course, is in Philadelphia with the injury to Joel Embiid.
Yeah, I mean, just awful luck. Embiid runs into Markel Fultz's shoulder, fractures his orbital bone, and suffers a concussion. He had his surgery, I believe, on Saturday, and the last estimate I saw in terms of absence was from Zach Lowe actually before the surgery happened, and that was 2 to 4 weeks per league source. And that 2 to 4 week timeline, 2 weeks was basically the start of the playoffs at the time it was set.
Yeah, and you'll remember there's been a couple of these. Joe Johnson, for example, suffered a facial fracture in the 2005 playoffs, came back but wasn't quite the same. Mike Conley had that magical game 2 in 2015 against the Warriors, his first game back, but then really wasn't quite himself either. We've seen Derrick Rose, for example, struggle coming back from this type of injury, and especially if he's concussed, conditioning could be a concern. And you have to remember too that Joel, due to his health concerns, doesn't really get to condition that much anyway, other than playing in games. And so the good news for Philly is things have been going great for them. They've been beating the teams that they should be beating in without him, even though Šarić missed today with an inflamed elbow as well. So they're still on track, but that April 6th game against Cleveland is not looking nearly as likely now for them to win and could result perhaps in them being more likely to fall into the fourth seed. But we'll keep an eye on where Embiid is. Them winning a playoff run certainly seems unlikely if he's not going to be available. And then it's also, if he is available, it's going to be a question of how limited he's going to be in terms of minutes and what kind of shape he's in.
We can go from there to the drama in Miami, where Hassan Whiteside went on a tirade that would not necessarily be appropriate for many podcasts, but we swear, so it's okay. And he said, basically, so he was pulled with 4 minutes to go in the third quarter in a game, I believe Miami won, right? Or no, I can't remember if they won or lost. But he said, basically, at the end, in response to being pulled out, he said, it's bullshit. It's really bullshit, man. There's a lot of teams that could use a center. Shit, that's bullshit.
Yeah, and they did, in fact, lose in overtime to the Brooklyn Nets at home.
That's right.
And some interesting periphery to this, recall that he'd been out with a hip injury for some time. Spo had actually asked him to ask out of the game when he got tired, which he had to do after the first 4 minutes of the game. But Brooklyn, of course, likes to go small. They like to spread the floor. Spo was asked about it before Whiteside had his comments, and he said he had some good moments tonight. They went to the smaller lineup, and it always comes to that. Does the speed lineup get to size, or size get to speed? And their speeds got to our size for a little bit. And Whiteside also asked if he was questioning his future with the team. Whiteside said, I don't know, maybe, and said he didn't know who he would take the issue up with, but you have to imagine that the trade market will be cool for someone owed over $25 million each of the next two seasons, including a player option in the fourth year of that contract, which I could see it picking up.
Yeah, and we're going to see a lot of supply for centers, because even guys, Nick Vucevic makes half the money Whiteside does, and for 1 year rather than two, and it could be even harder. And Whiteside is a more complete player than Vooch, to be sure, but the volume is going to be important there. I believe Tyler Johnson played in that game against Brooklyn. It was a little bit of a concern. He sprained his ankle, but Spo didn't think it was a big deal after their previous game, so I think that ended up being okay. Minnesota has been dealing with a series of different things. So the good news first, Jimmy Butler has been cleared for contact, but as Jerry Zagota pointed out, that does not mean that his return to playing in actual NBA games is imminent. It's an important step back. And then on Sunday, they lost. It was close early, but then they got the doors blown off them by the Utah Jazz, and Jeff Teague did not play in that game. Tyus Jones started, and there were some good moments for him, but I mean, and Aaron Brooks was the, even though Derrick Rose was eligible to play, Aaron Brooks was the first point guard off the bench.
Yeah, and for Butler, the Wolves don't play again until Thursday, so potentially that could be the target, especially if he can get in a couple of good practices now on those three off days to really get ready for battle there, and we'll see what kind of shape he's in when he comes back. But the good news is it sounds like at least his return, unless he suffers any setbacks, is going to happen before the end of the regular season, and maybe he'll have at least some modicum of time to get into rhythm. This is one that happened last week, but I really wanted to talk about it a little bit. McDonald's All-American Darius Bazley decommitted from Syracuse, and he is going to turn pro in the G League. And if you listen to it, the last pod that we did with Dylan Murphy, he was great on this. He was an assistant in the G League, then the D League, and we talked about how a star player right out of high school might fare. And for me, my concern is it all sounds like a great idea until you realize that whatever team has him doesn't really have the incentive to develop him within their organization, because they're not going to have the draft rights to him. There's a big chance that you're just developing him to go play for someone else. Now, it might be good, just simply, I think that teams will try to develop them even so, because it's good to have a star type of player in your organization. There's nothing bad, and to give that player as good of an experience as you can, just because it speaks well of your organization, and certainly your reputation around the league always matters for free agency. But nonetheless, the incentives there are a little off, especially because it's the rare 18-year-old, even in the G League, who's going to help you win games. And obviously there are players there and coaches whose livelihoods also depend on winning games down there. So it'd be very interesting to see how this turns out. I would imagine, I haven't heard anything about this yet, I don't know if there's anything public yet, that we'll find out that there's some sort of a shoe deal involved, involved here, which is going to make it worth his while more than, you know, the 25 grand that he would have earned in the G League. You know, if he can get a couple hundred thousand dollars, and hopefully this will get him some attention. I think it's maybe a smart business move for him. He can get paid. He can be kind of seen as a trailblazer, maybe get some endorsement money now, and hopefully develop better in the G League than he will in college. It'll be very interesting to see. You know that I'm not a huge proponent of guys developing in college. I think they develop better at the NBA level. Whether that's the case in the G League as well remains to be seen, but this will be probably the most talented guy we've ever seen, at least in terms of his reputation. I'm not familiar with his game personally, but in terms of his reputation coming in, McDonald's All-American, just go play right away in the G League is something that we haven't seen yet. What do you think?
I'm excited about it. At bare minimum, it could be the impetus for the NBA just figuring out how they really want to deal with these players, because the current structure can work, but as you said, the incentives are not really in line, especially if it becomes a higher volume. Like, let's say it's five guys in a year, that gets a lot more complicated than it being one. And I'm hopeful that it will work out. I am not a ardent supporter of the NCAA-based system, especially with the age limit. I think I've been encouraged by some of the development that's gone on overseas, and the NBA can do a very good job of it as well. So a good step in the process. We'll see how it works out, but I'm excited because this is going to be different than Latavius Williams, who jumped from high school to the G League because it has become this more fully formed thing over the last couple of years.
We could just hit on this very quickly. The Hall of Fame announced, I don't even want to go through who everyone is. The Basketball Hall of Fame is really this shadowy cabal that seems to be influenced quite a bit by Jerry Colangelo. No one even knows who the people are who vote for it. But Mo Cheeks making it over Chris Webber, like, you got to be kidding. I know Webber had a shorter peak than a lot of guys, but he certainly was a top 10 to 15 player for a 5 or 6 year run. And I don't know that Mo Cheeks, although he had a very solid career, a long career, I mean, was Mo Cheeks ever any better than the third best player on his own team? That doesn't mean that you can't get in, obviously, but, and was he a top 20 player in the league ever? I mean, I'm not really sure. As an offensive player, you know, he wasn't an amazing finisher. He'd run the team, but kind of, you know, that was in an era when there wasn't a lot of pick and roll. He didn't shoot three pointers. That wasn't something that people did back then, but he wasn't really like a dynamic scoring guard the way someone like an Isaiah Thomas was. So Cheeks making over Webber, really a massive surprise to me there. Where else do you want to go here?
Let's go to the Wizards. They got John Wall back. He played on Saturday and 15 points, 14 rebounds, or sorry, 14 assists, not rebounds, obviously, in 31 minutes in a game that they won. And then Wall sat for rest purposes in the loss to Chicago, shocking loss on Sunday. Otto Porter had he called it a tweak. It was kind of, you know, in that borderline between a tweak and a sprain of his ankle, but he played both games of this back-to-back that the Wizards split over the weekend. And Washington, this is about the latest in terms of getting Wall back and hoping that he could be something close to fully integrated. And now they're going to have to reconcile bringing Wall back with the improved play of Thomas Satoransky. And they can make this work. I mean, adding talent helps. I think the Wizards are better with John Wall, but it is going to be a challenge with so little left in the season and the 6-7-8 race in the East being so, so close.
Wait, they lost to the Bulls without him? I was told that they're better when he doesn't play. That's strange. San Antonio, I'll take this one because I know your policy. Kawhi Leonard has returned to New York to rehab with what Greg Popovich called his group. And Pop's quote was, referring to the outside doctors that Kawhi is consulting with, and Pop's quote was, I don't know when he and his group are going to feel like they are ready to go. If I knew, he'd be here. When he and his group feel he's ready, then he'll be ready. And obviously now with a week and a half left in the season, it becomes ever more unlikely, it would seem, that Kawhi will return. What else we got here?
Houston, now that they have clinched the number one overall seed in the playoffs, they're starting to be more aggressive in terms of resting guys, though Mike D'Antoni did say something on Sunday about getting back into a rhythm, and that is important. But Chris Paul sat in their loss to the Spurs with a hip thing, and earlier he sat discretionarily with some hamstring stuff. So that's worth keeping an eye on. But I'm not particularly concerned. They have time to get right. And one of the challenges for a lot of these teams, though, in the West, the high seeds, is they know where they're going to be. And so that leads teams to want to coaches to rest their guys a little bit because it's such a long season. But they might have to hit the ground running in the playoffs because the 7 and 8 seeds this year could be really strong.
Could be. And Paul, anything with muscle soreness for him should always be monitored with some of the issues that he has had. In Indiana, Trevor Booker did return tonight, playing only 34 minutes against the Clippers in a big win for the Pacers, 111-104. That may have put the nail in the coffin for the Clips playoff hopes, as they're now on 35 losses. But so Booker did return from that sprained ankle, but was -7 in 4 minutes. Didn't see it, how effective he was. For the Lakers, Brandon Ingram, we'll talk about their young players overall in the season a little bit later, but Brandon Ingram is in the concussion protocol now. Josh Hart did return against Milwaukee over the weekend after missing 4 weeks with the broken left hand, and Lonzo Ball bruised his left knee in trying to play pick and roll defense against Dirk Nowitzki, and did not play today in their loss to the Kings at home in an 84-83 barn burner.
Another injury in the front court for the Portland Trailblazers, who have already lost Mo Harkless due to that arthroscopic knee surgery with, you know, we'll see when he gets back, but Ed Davis sprained his right ankle, and he will be reevaluated in, I believe it was 1 to 2 weeks. He said today that he intends to come back in kind of before the end of the regular season, but again, intention is always hard with this kind of an injury. But in the playoffs, Portland is going to need him, especially if Harkless has to miss some time in their first round series.
For the Sacramento Tang Kings, Zach Randolph has missed 3 straight games. Actually now make it 4, given how he's played, especially defensively this year. I don't know that that actually helps their tank that much, and no real reason given for why he hasn't been playing other than just general veteran rustitude. For Phoenix, who I saw in person today, and we're going to talk about their young players tomorrow, Devin Booker remains out, as is TJ Warren. Alfred Payton has knee soreness. He is out for them as well. Alex Len is out with an ankle issue. Darren Dudley had an ankle issue. So they've really been scraping the bottom of the barrel there. Although they've had some guys with some energy out there today, some of whom we'll talk about tomorrow. But doesn't sound like the return for any of these guys is particularly imminent. And given their mission and their commanding lead for the top overall, I'll see in the lottery, I wouldn't see them wanting to jeopardize that by having these guys come back for like the last 3 games of the season or something of that ilk. And Payton, with him headed for restricted free agency in particular, you would think that he wouldn't want to be taking any risks with his sore knee.
There appears to be a little bit less discretion due to the circumstances in Orlando, but the basic story is the same. Fournier and Terrence Ross are out for the year. We've talked about that a little bit previously. And Jonathan Simmons has missed 6 straight games. He could be out too. And this is just a big stretch for them in terms of seeding, because Orlando had 4 consecutive double tank games. They already lost the first 2 to Chicago and Atlanta, and now they play at the Knicks and host Dallas for their last 2 of the year. So starting previous, I believe he was a 10-day contract, Rodney Purvis, and then they signed him to a rest of the season contract. Starting him and Wes Iwundu, theoretically at least, makes it harder to win those games than it would be.
Yeah, they are trying to play Aaron Jordan and Jonathan Isaac together, apparently. That's just get a look at what those guys are like together, but neither of them really quite the shooter I think that they would want to be, but it could be a solid defensive combination in time. For the Knicks, Courtney Lee remains out with left foot inflammation. He was originally supposed to play today, but then didn't. And Enes Kanter has a back injury, and he's had some lower back tightness at times in his career. So another one to watch there as a potential shutdown candidate. For Milwaukee, we've heard precious little until recently about both Malcolm Brogdon and Matthew Dellavedova. Brogdon, Tim Bontemps reporting that he was doing sprints at Bucks practice on Wednesday. Joe Prunty didn't want to put a timeline on Brogdon's return, but he should be back, according to Bontemps, before the playoffs begin. And then Dellavedova was originally supposed to miss only 4 weeks with that ankle sprain suffered against the Nets in early February, but suffered a setback in early March. He's still not playing, but he did say 4 days ago to the Australian media that he's confident that he will return for the playoffs, and it'll be interesting to see whether he or newly signed to rest of season contract Brandon Jennings gets backup point guard minutes. Obviously, Brogdon, Jason Terry will be in that mix as well. And just a moment here to discuss the Bucks' epic collapse today against the Nuggets.
Oh, man. I think you ended up watching about as much or more of it than I did. It was a game that had some crazy swings in it. Denver led, I think, by 15, and then Milwaukee took the lead, just bouncing back and forth. But then Denver was trailing by, I believe it was 15 with 7 minutes to go, came back and ended up down 3, and then a foul call that I believe you didn't agree with. at the end of it.
Yeah, Reggie Miller definitely committed an offensive foul in that play. Rather, Jamal Murray did. But the turnover to get Murray, that was incredible. I mean, the Bucks get fouled. It's the Nuggets foul to give with 4 seconds left. They're inbounding in the front court. they try to get it into Jason Terry and just throw it right to Jamal Murray. And not only right to Jamal Murray, but Jamal Murray with a head of steam going directly towards the other basket. Their Bucks are up three, and then Murray pulls up. Cherry is trying to chase him down, and Murray just sticks his right leg out. I mean, it was straight out of the NBA's demonstration video on how a shooter can commit an offensive foul. I mean, that if the last 2 minute report doesn't say that he committed an offensive foul, and you can see it so clearly on the angle from the baseline, how far outside the cone of his body and just to his right he sticks his leg out, they should just abolish the 2 minute reports at that point. But he did hit three clutch free throws as a over 90% free throw shooter, and then with Giannis having fouled out with about 3 minutes left in regulation, also got teed up as well. They probably could have used that point, as it turned out. And so now the Nuggets, their season remains on the respirator for a little while longer, and the Bucks had a chance to move into a tie for the sixth seed, and now they are back in eighth after having gotten some unexpected wins, at least by the projection systems, by beating the Warriors, and now they are still on track for the eighth.
Dennis Schroeder, we talked about his ankle injury. We got to have a more specific diagnosis now. He has a medial bone bruise and a grade 2 left ankle sprain. They listed the expected recovery time as 2 to 4 weeks, which is more than the rest of the regular season. The Hawks are not making the playoffs. And Bembry, who has really had a lost year, there is, quote, only some hope that he will play again this season. It's disappointing. Second year Hawks University guy, but just hasn't really had the chance to play much and show that potential. And it's just unfortunate whenever a young player can go through this, but I don't think it's going to affect like picking up his options or anything.
Yeah, and I mean, I saw him. He looked like he was moving around pretty well when they were here doing some pregame workouts. But with him having missed as much time, those abdominal injuries are tricky. And then Schroeder, we were at that game. He turned that left ankle all the way to the floor and then somehow came back in the game, which was preposterous. And then now he's going to miss 2 to 4 weeks and has a grade 2 left ankle sprain. I mean, the fact that he was enough of a badass to come back in the game was impressive, but equally unimpressive that he was allowed to with such a severe injury, especially in a game like this where, or in a season like this where, you know, they're not playing for anything. What else we got?
Speaking of not playing for anything, the Memphis Grizzlies did a pretty amazing one on, I believe that was Saturday or Friday, against the Jazz. So Marcus Gasol had 28 points on 11 of 12 shooting in the first three quarters and was plus 4 against the Jazz. Then JB Bickerstaff sits Gasol for the entire fourth quarter, claiming that he wanted to play their young guys, and unsurprisingly, the Memphis Grizzlies lost that game by 10.
And obviously, that's a little questionable. One of the things that's occurred to me, I'm by no means a fantasy basketball expert, but certainly fantasy football has been huge in the rise of the NFL, and I'm sure that the NBA would love it if people played fantasy basketball seriously. But like, what is it like to be a fantasy owner when your guy is just on fire and then they just take him out of the game because they don't want to win it? I mean, how frustrating must that be? And especially this is the end of the season when presumably you're gunning for your fantasy championship, and to have your league race be affected by that, it's got to just be like incredibly annoying. And obviously I'm not suggesting that fantasy basketball should determine player usage, but it's just you would think at least it'd be nice if when you're trying to make your decisions for your fantasy team, you could count on teams like actually trying to make the optimal decisions to like win games. Anyway, that's a brief aside. Also for them, Tyreke Evans is not with the team due to personal reasons, and starting to feel like another one of these that, you know what, hey, just go home for the rest of the season. Good thing they kept him around, by the way. It really that's what do you think the percent chance is that he returns there in the offseason? Maybe they'll just have the best offer if they give him the full MLE for 4 years or something.
Yeah, they can offer the full MLE now, I believe, and still stay under the tax, so it's possible. But I mean, does he really, in some ways this is a parallel to the whole Dwight Howard thing of like, maybe if you want this guy long term, and I'm not saying this was the case with Tyree because they signed him as a free agent, but it's better to not know what goes on, because this season has to have been dispiriting for Evans. He's had a good year individually, but the Grizzlies have been such a disaster due to injuries and just disappointment overall. So I think it's low, you know, like 15 to 20%, but again, the idea that they could make a better offer, though I don't see them offering like long term, you know, years, and he might be looking for that kind of, you know, maybe it's less salary but more years. That's possible.
Andrew Harrison also missing time for the Grizz with a wrist and shoulder injuries, and that has been Kobe Simmons' time getting a lot of playing playing time for them. For Golden State, Andre Iguodala missed the last two games with knee soreness. He had been playing extremely well, and then this happens to him a fair amount, it seems like, where if he really tries to kick it into gear, a lot of times on like a landing from a dunk, he'll end up, or a power layup off of 1 foot, he'll end up aggravating that knee tendonitis. And so say he's making progress, maybe he can return this week, but too bad for him since he'd been playing so well. In Denver, Gary Harris remains out, probably about a week away, it seems like, according to Mike Malone, as of Friday. So no sign that he's on his way back. And then with the Pistons, Blake Griffin, you have to imagine he's going to be done for the year. They haven't officially announced that, but he's only going to be reevaluated in a week with a right ankle bone bruise, and he'll be given a timetable for return as of that point. And then finally in Dallas, JJ Barea has missed time for personal reasons. He's to return Tuesday against Portland. That actually probably won't help them beat Portland, but Barea has actually been their most effective point guard this year in terms of actually winning games. So that will help them win games in theory. And then and they have that big matchup against the Magic coming up, that huge double tank game. And then finally, in Cleveland, a little news there before we move on to the Lakers.
Yeah, the early thing that happened right after we recorded our last show was Ty Lue rejoined the Cavs in their game against New Orleans, but as an observer. So he's making his way back to coaching. Larry Drew still is on the sidelines for them. George Hill had an ankle sprain. I have not seen any specific timeline yet. He did not play in their win over the Mavericks today. And then Kyle Korver is dealing with some soreness in his right foot, of course also the recent tragic loss of his brother, and he also did not play in their win against the Mavericks.
I forgot, we had two more things. Cody Zeller is out for the season, as we foreshadowed it in the last episode, with knee soreness. And then Marcus Smart declared that he hopes to return for the second round of the playoffs, coming off that thumb surgery. And Kyrie Irving, a week after his surgery, Brad Stevens said he's basically just been bending his knee on the training table and hasn't been able to do much else as of yet, but no idea whether that's like on track for the 3 to 6 weeks, you know, the lower end of that timetable or not. I will get to the Lakers momentarily, but first, with the national championship game tomorrow and no NBA basketball, we will have a show, but maybe you want to watch a little college basketball. With so many games in NCAA March Madness, you never know what's going to happen. Well, there's only one left now, but presumably you've been going to Walmart before every round to stock up on Coca-Cola, Coke Zero Sugar, and Powerade before the next round tips off. Coca-Cola is, of course, the official fan refreshment of the NCAA, and you can watch all the games by picking up Coca-Cola and Powerade all turning long. NCAA March Madness isn't just one game, it's a whole tournament. Make sure that you're ready. Refresh every round by heading to Walmart to pick up Coca-Cola, Coke Zero Sugar, and Powerade. So since Danny and I have spoken so much about the Lakers young players of late, we did a huge breakdown on Brandon Ingram. We've done multiple of Lonzo Ball over the course of the year. Thought this would be a good time to get some fresh eyes on this team with our intern Liam Doyle. So Liam, why don't you start us off here with the Lakers? We'll go through their fundamentals quickly. 33-43, 2-5 since we last checked in on them. Their negative 1.0 net rating is 21st in the NBA, and they have the 23rd ranked offense and the 13th ranked defense, projected to finish with 35 wins. So why don't we start with 20-year-old Lonzo Ball, just if we want to take a quick look at his season overall. What'd you see?
I think you got to start with just some of the weaknesses, just because they've been so glaring. Scoring frequency and efficiency have been, you know, a big problem for him all season. He's ninth on the team in usage, and he has a dreadful 44% true shooting percentage. And I wanted to take a look at those numbers since February 1st to see if, you know, he's gotten better over the course of the year, if he's had, you know, improvement over the last 2 months. And really,
yeah, because it was much ballyhooed. It was much ballyhooed when he returned from that knee injury that, oh, he's shooting so much better now, but that seems to have regressed of late.
Yeah, and he had that, you know, really rough stretch to start the year, but even, you know, after, since February 1st, he's really struggling too. 46% true shooting percentage, the usage is about the same. And if you just look at like every area that he's shooting on the floor, he's not a threat from anywhere. He's, you know, an awful 48% at the rim, 32% from mid-range, 31% three is probably the area he's best at. And a lot of his problems, you know, if he's going to be, you know, a great distributor, main ball handler, you know, his passing vision is obviously such a strength, but he needs to, you know, be able to score, you know, in the paint to draw the big over and, you know, create passing angles and be able to take advantage of that strength. And right now he can't really do that because of his lack of a finishing ability. And just like, I tried to watch as many of his finish attempts as I could on NBA.com, and a lot of the time I thought he was avoiding contact, and he's got a really low free throw rate. And I don't know if he's avoiding that because he's such a bad free throw shooter with 45% on the year, which is another concern. But he's got a small frame that he kind of bounces off bigger defenders. He's not looking for contact. He's not very flexible when he's jumping, and he doesn't really get up very high off 1 foot. I know he has some plays where he'll get up pretty well off of two, catch those lobs off those cuts that he had a lot of at UCLA, but off one, when he's trying to, you know, drive through the lane, he'll kind of, you know, angle out to the side and won't really get up vertically. And that's definitely a concern, and especially when you factor in that 20% of his possessions are coming in transition, at where he's an awful 0.77 points per possession in transition, which is practically unheard of. So you got to think a lot of those shots are at the rim, and if he can't finish those, how's he going to be able to finish in the half?
Yeah, part of it too, with those point guards are always going to have lower point per possession in transition because transition is a high turnover time, and point guards are usually the ones pushing the ball who are going to commit those turnovers. So you'll usually see that those guys just are lower in general than like a wing or a big, where you're pretty much just finishing the play more often. But certainly the fact that he has not been able to get to the rim against any kind of opposition. I mean, remember, he shot that fantastic 70% at the rim at UCLA, but a lot of that was just being very judicious about his finishing attempts and not really going in and finishing over bigger players. I watched him work out before the Lakers played at Golden State, and the coaches are saying, hey, you're 6'6", like, extend the ball out in front of you. We want you to be able to beat guys with your length. And he seemed to have like a little bit of trouble processing that. You know, he's not really getting great extension. I'm not sure how big his hands are in terms of like the ability to move the ball around with one hand. I mean, and you don't see any kind of the craft from him that you see from some smaller point guards. They floaters, the one hand, right hand, right foot, left hand, left foot type of finishes. The floater game has gotten a little bit better, but it still doesn't look natural to him. He kind of shoots his floater with like sort of the same shooting motion that he has normally, which of course is kind of weird. So he's definitely, because of I think the way that he shoots, and you know, and he's able to do some amazing things with the ball, especially as a passer, but he just doesn't really seem comfortable finishing in some of the conventional ways that we see most point guards and guys who drive to the basket be able to finish.
Yeah, and he's not finishing in those areas that you need a point guard to finish, as far as like pick and roll ball handler, ISO. He 0.61 points per possession as a pick and roll handler, 0.63 points per possession as in ISO. So that's really concerning that he hasn't been able to, you know, develop that over the course of the year. And the shooting's another problem, just spotting up, and obviously the pull up with his form is another issue. But even as a spot up shooter, 45% free throw percentage, you know, this late in the season is really concerning for a point guard. And especially, he was a great shooter at UCLA, but in high school, if now correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think he was known as a, you know, high level shooter. So then
he would take a lot of shots, you know, and take a lot of deep shots, but they didn't go in that much. You know what I mean? I think in like Draft Express's database, which is, you know, gets higher level competition, certainly. And I think he was at like 29% across like AAU games, like his junior and senior year, you know, Adidas Nations, like those type of competitions.
Yeah. And there's definitely some doubt that's starting to creep into my mind about, you know, was that 1 year at UCLA, you know, was that kind of, I don't know, fluky, maybe the wrong word, but that not as indicative what type of shooter he is overall. And I feel like I've only been saying negative things about him, despite everything that, you know, I've gone through.
Yeah,
so
you
far.
Have.
Well, I had the good stuff saved for the second section.
Yeah.
So
No, that's fair. That's fair.
I still believe in him, you know, a lot as a player. I think he's going to be a pretty high level starter just because of the way he sees the game and the passing acumen, obviously. I don't need to go too much into the passing. I think everybody, you know, knows how special he is in that area. And I wanted to take a look at how much the tempo changes with him in the game. And the amount of possessions in transition really increases with him in the game. And like we've gone over before, when you're getting those positions in transition, they're so much more valuable than a half-court possession. So that he gets a lot of value there. And defensively, he's been much better than I think most could have anticipated with him coming into the year. He still struggles in some areas. He's not as good on ball. Laterally, I don't think he's great, just, you know, one-on-one against guys. He's not great at getting skinny through screens off ball, and he fell behind on a lot of those wide pin downs that I saw him defend. But I think he's really fantastic when he has to roam, you know, when he's guarding somebody on the weak side. He's allowed to, you know, see where guys are trying to throw the ball and get those steals. He's got a great steal percentage, great block percentage. He's got long active hands. There were a couple times where they'd ice the down screen, you know, force the point guard down towards the baseline, and he was really good at jumping up and being active, denying that pass back to the big man. So I think there's a lot of, you know, good things to build off of as far as him as a defensive player, that especially when you factor in his defensive rebounding percentage, that if he's not going to be as potent of a scorer, you know, he's going to need to be a more impactful defender, and I think he can be.
Yeah, and he closes on the ball really quickly too. He has a great sense for, you know, when a post player has turned his back, when, you know, really the black hole post player has reached the event horizon and the ball's not coming out of there, and he's just going to go for the turnaround jumper. You know, he'll come and block that or sneak around behind someone when he turns his back to goal and poke the ball away. So he's real good at that, real good at getting in the passing lanes, much better, I think, as an off-ball defender, to be sure. It needs to get stronger. I think a lot of where he can improve is as a switch guy, but he's not quite strong enough to deal with bigger players in the post as of yet. And you mentioned his defensive rebounding, which is really outstanding. And obviously when he gets a defensive rebound, he can push the ball. So I'm going to put you on the spot here. Where do you see his ultimate destiny being? Obviously, it's very early in his career. A lot of these things that we talked about could improve, but where do you see him kind of settling in as a player? Can he be an all-star? Can he be the type of player that people thought he could be coming out of school? Is he going to be a solid starter? Like, what do you see him ultimately evolving into?
If I had to bet right now, I'd bet on him making, I don't know, one or two all-star games, you know, having a good season. I'd be pretty surprised if he was an all-NBA type guy. So I think, you know, short of that area, but, and I don't want to like fully compare him to this player, but I mean, Jason Kidd, you look at some of the struggles that he had during his rookie year and his ability to improve his shooting, obviously becoming a great three-point shooter. Now, obviously that's, you know, unprecedented, you know, improvement besides Jason Kidd, but like there are avenues for him to become a more potent scorer, and especially with all of his other, you know, skills. I think it's pretty, I think it's very likely that he's going to be a high quality starter, and I think he will make like an all-star game or two down the line, depending on his development overall. And obviously he's going to get the Los Angeles fan vote bump, so maybe he'll even get voted in one time. But I'd have to guess there. What about you? Where do you see, you know, his peak or, you know, expected value of his career?
I could see him getting there, certainly because of all the strengths that we've discussed, but the scoring and the shooting is just so much of a weakness right now, and he just has so many massive improvements that need to be made, whether it's being able to create separation off the dribble. You know, that's not something that we really discussed a lot, but just being able to blow by a guy, you know, we haven't really seen that for him, the crossover, the advanced dribble moves to create separation, you know, that we haven't seen a ton of that. Gotten a little bit better in pick and roll operation, but the floater game he's got to work on, just being able to pull up for a normal jump shot. He's taking some baby steps there. He's taking some baby steps in terms of being able to shoot going to his right, being able to hit three-pointers and to hit difficult three-pointers, which is really, you know, as a spot-up guy coming off of screens, you know, is he going to be able to do all of that? Is he going to be able to finish at the rim? Is he actually going to make some free throws? If he doesn't improve his free throw shooting, and I mean, you know, he's one of these guys. When I saw him warm up, he made 14 out of 15 free throws. So, but especially when you consider just kind of how weird and unorthodox his game is, I think he could get there, but there's so many boxes that have to be checked. And then you're just looking at, you know, how many guards who score under 15 points a game, which, you know, I could see him being in that level. You know, he's gonna have to get so efficient if he's not gonna be a high usage guy, in addition to his passing. Again, he has such great strength that if he could even just get to be like passable in some of the areas we're talking about, it could be, maybe he could get to an all-star level. And he's always going to be a guy, I think, who, you know, the traditional box score stats underrate what he's doing a little bit. And he looks really good in the RPM numbers. So if I had to bet, if you put a gun to my head, does he make an all-star team? Or I guess more accurately, will he deserve to make an all-star team in his career? I'm going to say no. Maybe there's the LA fan boost or just the coaches, because he gets a lot of attention or whatever, vote for him. But in whether he will deserve to make it, in my opinion, I'm going to say probably not. But it's, even if he becomes a quality starter for a while, I mean, that's the number two pick is no sure thing. So that's not like he's going to be a complete failure if he doesn't make an all-star team. Let's move now to Brandon Ingram, also age 20. Remember, he has that late September birthday, turns 21 September of this year. What have you seen from him this season?
Well, I came away, maybe it was just my expectations of what the season would be. I came away a little bit unimpressed with what I saw, just like watching him. And then I looked into the numbers and I was more impressed again. So I just touching on a couple of things. I think he's gotten a
lot
better.
Wait, that's interesting. So you're saying you weren't impressed watching him, but you were impressed by the numbers. So I think generally for most people who would say the opposite about him.
Well, why don't I just jump into a couple of the numbers that impressed me, at least. I think overall, just like his offensive burden has really increased overall. Like, his usage has jumped from 17% to 22%. Assist percentage has jumped from 10% to 18%. A lot more of his buckets are unassisted. So he's carrying a lot more of a load for the team overall. And especially when you factor in, you know, how young he is, he has a 54% true shooting percentage. And that's not, you know, great efficiency. But at that young age, with, you know, this type of like creation burden that he has, especially on a team with not a lot of spacing, I came away, I don't know, I thought it was better than I thought it would be watching him. Just because when you watch him, he doesn't have that many like athletic plays, or, you know, and you've mentioned this before, like plays where his length sticks out. I think a lot of the plays I watch, he'd drive into the paint, and if he had a smaller defender, he'd kind of just finish over him with length or shoot over him with length. And if it was like a big that was dropped in a pick and roll, he'd just run into the big and not really know what to do. And part of that is his inability. He's really bad in the non-restricted paint area. He's 24% on the year. So he's totally like given up on that shot in the games I've seen. So, you know, with a guy that is not a, you know, high volume 3-point shooter, he's going to be attacking the basket downhill. And when he doesn't have that, you know, pull up or stop short option, a lot of the time he just stop, turn around, you know, look for a guy at the 3-point line, and a lot of them were turnovers. So it wasn't like the most aesthetically like pleasing style of, you know, way to play. But I was really impressed with, you know, like I said, a lot of the numbers, and especially when you factor in how much he's getting in the line. So even though he's not having a lot of those highlight plays, that's helping his efficiency a lot. So I just thought as a scorer, he was better than I thought. I mean, so have, I don't know, you've talked about him a lot, but like, do those numbers do anything to change your mind about, like, I don't know, how he's played or your evaluation of him?
Not particularly. I mean, with Ingram, it's just such a challenge to really calibrate for me where he's going, because you brought up the idea of trajectory, and I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that idea in terms of him as a scorer. As a creator for other people, yeah, he certainly looked more capable, but I mean, just the nature of how teams defend him. The biggest thing that might end up happening is also if he can become a smaller cog in a much better machine. And the problem with that, though, is it would take Ingram more off ball, and he's been best on ball this year.
Yeah, and these are not the be-all end-all, and he was suffering with a groin injury, but seeing him shoot, you know, is basically right around 50% on NBA threes, and he definitely has really passed up those shots unless he's been in the corner, not really looking to take that shot off the dribble. Much like Giannis, actually, he took a lot more three-pointers last year in his first year, and then Giannis was kind of told to chill out on that. I'm not sure whether Ingram has been told that. I think the mid-ranger has looked okay, and I disagree with you a little bit here, Liam. I think he's been able to, you know, he's not blowing by guys, but he's able to get into the lane a fair amount with that hesitation dribble, which is really where a lot of it starts. We talked about that in our breakdown, whatever it was, about a month ago for him. And I mean, I think if you're going to talk about like the growth that we wanted to see from him this year, I think other than the three-point shooting, we've probably seen it in every area. And, you know, just where I disagree on Ingram, I think with a lot of people in Laker fandom, is just I don't see the absolute like top end superstar upside unless he just gets to be a way better shooter or way more athletic than he's shown so far. But what do you see as kind of his ceiling? Same kind of question there as we were talking about with Lonzo, Liam.
That's a tough one, because I don't know. Maybe I keep going like back and forth on it. I think I kind of settled in. I kind of like Lonzo's, you know, future a little bit more, just because, and this is something that like really stuck with me with something that you've said, and I tried to watch for it, is, you know, his length doesn't pop out. So when you're watching, like, he doesn't have, you know, a great rebound percentage for someone his size. I think, you know, he doesn't get a ton of steals, and it's just as far as the passing lane and just contesting guys. Like, I think a couple times he got, you know, bodied and knocked back, and his length kind of got negated on a couple of his contests. So he wasn't like big defensive impact hope you would get with a guy with, I think it's a 7'4" wingspan and a wing that's like really mobile. So when you factor, I don't know, he's like average-ish defensively right now, and he could have definitely improved in that area. And I definitely agree that I don't think he has like superstar, like number one option offensive potential, but I kind of think he settles in as, you know, a pretty good, you know, starter. And I'm not quite sure I see all-star with, but I don't know, ask me, you know, 2 months into next season, and I could, you know, think differently.
All right, well, when we do our top 10 prospects list, that actually it. And one other thing to note on both Ingram and Ball is one of those guys better figure out how to shoot, because with them, and then if Julius Randle is still gonna be a part of this core too, who we're gonna get to, you're just not gonna have enough shooting on the floor with those three guys if, you know, at least one of those guys isn't shooting a pretty high volume and shooting in the high 30s from three. Let's move to maybe the biggest surprise rookie. No, that'd probably be Donovan Mitchell, but maybe the second biggest surprise rookie of this season, Kyle Kuzma, the 22-year-old out of Utah. And the first thing you have written down here is the biggest thing that jumped out to you was that he took took some really bad shots, which you take as a good sign. Can you explain that?
Yeah, just then, he's at a 55% true shooting percentage right now with a pretty high usage rate for a rookie. And especially, I think I saw this note that you had somewhere else in the doc that we have. Like, a lot of the rookies' true shooting percentages are, really low, mid-40s. So when you take in the fact that, he's, creeping up towards league average on a pretty good usage rate for a rookie, I think that's a good sign that, if you take away some of those bad shots, and a lot of it's, I don't think that he doesn't have the ability to get better shots. A lot of the shots I saw were, early shot clock or the game winner that he tried to take against Milwaukee. He shot a three with, Giannis, directly in his face when, he didn't necessarily have to, and he had time to make a move off of that. And there are a lot of other plays like that where I thought that he was, taking a jumper with two guys near him or stuff like that, and that's something that I think will kind of get cleared up a little bit with the Lakers personnel. I assume they'll try and get more shooting in there. That's going to be a big offseason priority for them. So, and a little bit more of a space court, because right now he's probably the best spacer that they have. Maybe you could argue Brook Lopez just with his ability to pull out the big, although he hasn't shot it great this year, I think. But when he's the one that's driving and attacking, everybody else is pitching into the lane. We've talked about how Ingram and Lonzo don't have that gravity off ball, and if they're playing with Randall too, that's not a floor spacer either. So I kind of take it as a good sign, and I don't that he's taking bad shots and his efficiency is still that good. I guess that's what I mean, because I still think he's got pretty good quickness. I liked his driving ability, his offensive, creativity, just his ability to get good shots. And I thought he was taking bad ones that he didn't have to, not necessarily that he couldn't get better. I don't know. Does that make any sense? Do you agree with that, or am I just?
Yeah, I think so. And he does have a high skill level. I think sometimes too, a player who has a rapid advance in his skill level, the way Kuzma has. I mean, remember, he wasn't really even a good 3-point shooter at Utah. So to be this level of shooter, taking some of the shots you're talking about and making him at a decent enough clip, it is impressive. But I think sometimes when you improve that much, it's kind of hard to know. You get so much confidence in your newfound abilities that it's almost hard to know where they end, and so that might be part of what he's going through. But the usage is not that high. I would like to see, and because of the Lakers personnel, I think this has been difficult to see him get a chance to work one-on-one a little bit more, especially either, not necessarily facing up off the dribble, but I think his post game, his ISO triple threat game has been really good. And the other thing that I've been really impressed by, although he hasn't finished incredibly well at the rim, in part, I think, because of, again, the issues you talked about with him being one of the key spacers on the team. And so there's no spacing when he tries to drive. But his floater game is really fantastic. He's shooting one of the better percentages, shoots a lot of those shots. And these are not easy floaters either, where someone throws it to him at the dotted line and he just throws up a floater. These are plays where he's driving to the rim. He's got to pull up a little bit earlier and float one high off the glass. That's really impressed me for him.
Yeah, and especially those running hook shots. I swear, early in the year, every time he took one, I was like, why are you taking that? And then it would be a perfect swish.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, he takes a lot of these shots where you're like, wow, I can't believe that went in.
Yeah,
but if it happens often enough, then you got to start believing in it a little bit.
And I definitely started believing in it just because, you said, that's such a high number of attempts. It's hard to believe that that's, really all that fluky. And another thing I was wondering about, do you think that he's capable of playing a lot of minutes small forward? This year they've had him at 20% of his minutes at small forward. I think offensively he's a better threat as a mismatch at power forward, but something you guys have touched on a lot is there aren't a lot of quality small forwards in the league, and if he can pinch up a position, whether it's those minutes that Ingram isn't playing small forward, I think that could be pretty valuable. And especially if he's kind of got a little bit of a post game, if he could take his advantage of some of those size mismatch. And defensively, I thought he moved pretty well laterally. I mean, he has his other problems, but I didn't think he was way outmatched there. I mean, do you think he can shift and play some of those minutes?
Well, what's interesting about that idea is I don't think he's going to be a plus defender anywhere. So maybe just let's say he's a step down as a three than as a four. That would make it an interesting play. And I would say they shouldn't game plan for it. I think you want to build your personnel theory of Kuzma around him being a four. But then if the opportunity presents itself, especially if you have a capable rim protecting five, which I think it would be a prerequisite in a lot of these different alignments, then sure, you can try it out.
His limitations to me mostly come as an off-ball defender, where early in the year in particular, he's been better of late. He had comically low block and steal rates, just not a guy who is protecting the rim as a help defender in the slightest. But yeah, I mean, I think he could have the skill level to play the three. Do you want him, if he's going to play the three, he's got to guard. And we talked about this when we looked at the worst defensive small forwards, that there really are not very many players who start at the three who actually are not great, I shouldn't say not great, but are not very good defenders, because there's a need for that position to defend. And if he's going to start there, if he's going to guard the other team's all-star three, you know, I don't think that that's really going to work out very well. But certainly they can steal some minutes there. They've been forced to with all the injuries that they've had and just the dearth of small forwards on the roster to begin with. Once again, for him, I mean, what do you see as his eventual role, especially considering that he's a little older than some of the other guys we're talking about at 22?
I think he's got a pretty big range of outcomes. I think he'd be an ideal, like, smaller four in the modern game that can, you know, shoot, drive, pass, dribble, all that stuff. So I'd say most likely he's a starter, and he's, you know, a pretty useful one at that. But I could also see, you know, ranges where, you know, this is his best offensive season and he kind of falls off after this. I mean, I don't know. It's tough to not overreact to, you know, a full season of, you know, strong play. But I think, you know, where he came from last year has to factor in a little bit. Just taking a look at, you know, what type of player we thought he was coming into the year, I think that has to factor a little bit in equation how you value him long term.
Yeah, and the defense as well. I think, you know, I think he's going to be a valuable scorer. And I do think, I mean, in ISO, 1.14 points per possession, that's awesome. 92nd percentile. Post-ups, 1.07 points per possession, that's 91st percentile. And combined, that's over about 140 possessions on the season. So I would like to see him get more of these chances, maybe with some more spacing he can. Just my gut feels like he's going to be more of a scoring forward off the bench who maybe closes the game if it's the right matchup due to some of his defensive limitations. And maybe they feel like, all right, if you're going to switch everything, we can get by with him, or maybe he can get better as a help defender. But I'm not sure that you want him as your starting four unless you're going to have a really good defensive center, which does not appear to be in the pipeline here anytime soon. But let's move to Julius Randle, a breakout season for the 23-year-old.
Well, speaking of not so strong defensive centers, he has definitely had his struggles, you know, in that area this season. And he's a guy that last year I actually believed in a little bit more than I think most people. And then this year, I know he's played way better, but now I think a lot of people are saying, like, you know, he should be paid big money over the summer, or like paid starter money. And I'm not sure I quite buy that yet. And he's got, you know, obviously phenomenal strengths when you take a look at his ability to score in the paint. He's improved his percentage at the rim. He's shooting 70% at the rim this year, 61% last year. 61% true shooting percentage. He's a really effective, you know, offensive player overall. He gets the line a ton. And down low, he's just a load with his strength and his speed. Like, the combination of strength and speed that he has, like, I don't know how many guys in the league, you know, have that, you know, type of combination. I don't know, maybe like 10, you know, not many. But the problem is just there's not a lot of, like, refinement to a lot of that. He still won't go right at all. Like, the number of times that he, like, he must lead the league in charges, just going, you know, right into guys' chest when they're, like, facing, like, completely towards the sideline, trying to prevent him from going left, and he'll still barrel into him because he refuses to go right. And he even missed the, it would have been the go-ahead basket in the Milwaukee game. He shot a left-handed layup on the right side. So, like, those limitations just aren't going to go away. I feel like if he was going to, you know, start to develop that right hand, he would have done it a little bit by now. And the bigger problems are just, like, defensively to me. He hasn't expanded his game outside the paint at all offensively. So if he's not going to be a stretch, you know, big, he has to provide some interior defense and play some at center, I think, in the modern NBA. And he hasn't been able to do that defensively as much to me. I thought he was really inconsistent with a lot of his rotations. He doesn't have, you know, great length to wall up and, you know, have good verticality when he's protecting the rim. He has a good, you know, thick chest that guys are going to bounce off of some. But teams are shooting 41% of their shots at the rim when he's at center. And that's way too many for any lineup. So I still worry about his defensive ability. Have you guys, you know, seen much improvement in his defensive awareness and his ability to play center? Because that's really what it comes down to. If you believe that he can be, you know, a quality defensive center and even just, like, you know, be the foundation, like the starting center on a league average defense team, then I think he is worth the money. But, like, I'm not convinced that he can be that.
Well, to me, for Randle, he could be effective as a switch guy. I think he's looked good, even against some of the better players in the league, switching onto them and teams trying to attack them. Now, you have to have the right personnel around that. It's not just about your center being able to switch, but then you got to have the rest of your team as well. And maybe with Lonzo, if he can get a little bit stronger, he's a larger point guard, maybe that can be part of their attack. I thought when he's played the four next to Lopez and he's had to play in a conventional non-switching system, that's when his weaknesses have really showed up. And you mentioned the problems as a help defender. I think he could be real good denying penetration, but in conventional pick and roll defense, his angles are all wrong. He really fails to execute there, even though you would think with his mobility he could be better. So I do worry about his defense. I mean, they have defended much better than expected this year. He's been a part of that. And I also agree with what you said about him being such a massive problem as a matchup guy, because you can say, okay, we're going to put our center on you, right? Oh, well, that's fine. You just back off. He can't shoot anything. Well, he's quick enough that, as you mentioned, he can get past the guy, get a shoulder into him, and he can even finish over some of the bigger centers once he's able to get past him. He is just such a bull with his strength. And, you mentioned the right hand. It actually is better, amazingly. I mean, as hard as that is to say, he still doesn't really like to do it, but his explosion is enough that he can kind of even jump over guys even when he's bringing the ball back into him. And then, obviously, if you go with the skinnier guy on him who can hold up against his quickness, now he's really just that guy's probably going to just get run over legally a lot of the times, although I know he does commit a lot of charges. But so he is a guy where he can be very, very difficult to stop. But again, you do wonder of how good can he be as a support player. He can't shoot at all. He's kind of got to play center. Can he really be, among the best players on a good team when you consider some of the fit issues around him? I mean, I guess probably the defensive analog to him would be Tristan Thompson. But even Thompson has like a 7'4 wingspan and is probably a better rim protector even than Randall is. Randall is a pretty limited wingspan, as I recall, like under 7 feet, I think.
Can I ask you, let's say you're like a team that needs, a big or a starting center, like in this market, and obviously context matters, but just in the, in the general sense, like what are you offering him, Saucy?
Well, Eric Pincus reported that the Lakers could have had him for an extension starting at his cap hold this summer, which would have been $12.4 million, and then would have presumably had 8% raises going up. So that probably would have averaged out to about $14 million or so per season. The question just becomes who the other suitors are for him. This may not be the place to talk about that necessarily, but I think he's shown such ability as a scorer, and he's young enough and he does have those quick feet defensively that I think I don't know if I'd be comfortable just giving him starter type of money, like $15 million a year, but I don't think it would be crazy to do that. I might want to start a little bit lower, but I do think something with eight figures, because of the matchup problems that he causes, and maybe he can't close every game for you, but especially if you have a team that's like struggling to score on the bench, he could be really useful there. So I don't know, it could be that this breakout for him is a little bit of a mirage, but certainly when you consider how much more efficient he's been than in past years and just how much trouble teams have had dealing with him as a matchup problem, I mean, I like those guys who look like they really can't be stopped unless you have like a truly special kind of player, and Randall has shown some signs of that this year. And so I think just because of that potential, maybe you do try to take a chance on him. It just depends where you are as a team, and that's something we'll talk about obviously in their offseason preview, or maybe when we probably actually more when we look at the power forwards and the bigs when we go through the free agent class later on. Let's talk about the rest of their guys quickly here. Josh Hart at age 22 showed some role player potential this year. What are your impressions of him?
I really like him as a guy that can like fit in a lot of lineups, and I just think like in a playoff series, like he'll be able to stay on the floor, and be a threat on both sides of the ball. He doesn't have any mid-range game to speak of. I think in college too, he tried to avoid those shots as much as he could, and it's the same in the pros as well. I think he's only
that's fine for me. It doesn't bother me at all given his role.
That's exactly what you want from a role player. He's only taken 32 shots out, between three-point line and outside, the restricted area all season, and he's 42% 65% from the rim. He's a great rebounder for a wing. A lot of really good, reads defensively, rotations. He doesn't have the greatest lateral quickness. I don't think it's like a huge, I don't think he's like a sieve, but like he's not great in that area. He got beat a couple times by De'Aaron Fox today and just a couple other guys with, really nice crossovers. And he doesn't have quite the length to be a small forward or the size. He doesn't have a great lower body as far as strength. He definitely competes in that area, but he'll get posted up by some of the bigger guys and unable to contest like taller small forwards like Middleton got him for a couple step back jumpers. But I also like just the way he fits in, especially with the Lakers. Like, he's a really good cutter, runs the floor well, and those are really valuable attributes for when you're playing with a guy like Lonzo. So not a guy with a ton of upside overall. I just like him as a really solid guy that I think he could fit most lineups as two guard. Switching, he might not be the most effective guy, but there's a lot of things that he can do that scream like guy that you can play in a playoff series. I don't know, what have you seen?
Well, he does have a pretty big wingspan for his size, maybe not for a small forward, but he's in the high 6 foot. I've even seen it reported as high as 7 foot, which seems maybe a little extreme. I don't know that it's that high, but and he's got some strength and he's going to continue to add strength. Yeah, he's going to get scored on some, but I think, you know, he's not so skinny that guys could just go right through. I think he can provide something as a switch defender, and then, you know, he plays hard, he gets out in transition, hits some shots. Yeah, not bad with the 30th pick. You know, I think he's definitely, you know, is he ready to start quite yet? You know, maybe not. Maybe you need a little bit more shooting because, you know, he's not really, would you agree with this? He's not really like, he's more of a, okay, we'll throw it to you when you're open and you make the shot than like a guy who's really going to be able to come off screens and shoot or really, you know, has a lot of versatility to a three-pointer at this point.
I'd agree with that right now. I think that's definitely something you can improve on. Like, he's not going to, you know, fly. He doesn't have that like J.J. Redick type gravity where you're running plays from all the time trying to open up slips to the big. I agree. He doesn't have that yet.
And I think also just as a four-year guy coming out of Villanova where he's very well coached, Villanova has a good reputation for player development. Seems like he really has a good idea from a scheme perspective of what they're trying to do defensively.
Yeah, I always go back to, I remember hearing Stan Van Gundy, you know, defend J.J. Redick's defense when he was back with Orlando. I remember him saying like he always knew that J.J. Redick was going to execute, you know, the scheme the way he needed to. And I think that's another thing that coaches are going to value a ton. Like, he's going to be a guy that gets, you know, a lot of playing time just because he's somebody that can trust. You know, coaches, you know, like reliability more than anything, and he's definitely going to give that to, you know, whoever he's playing.
All right, let's do 60 seconds on some of the rest of their guys here. Start with their two-way guy, Alex Caruso, who is at 23 out of Texas A&M, spent last year in a OKC system with the OKC Blue, but has been on a two-way with the Lakers this year.
Yeah, he had a big breakout in the Vegas Summer League. He was probably one of the best players there, and I think he's going to be a good backup long-term somewhere. He really hasn't shot the ball well in the NBA in 342 minutes. He's 7 of 38 outside the paint. He's been a total non-shooter in the NBA, but I don't think that's really all that indicative of, you know, how he is as a shooter overall. In 2 years in the G League, he's a 39% three-point shooter on like 3.5 attempts a game, and I don't think he's never had the rep as like a complete non-shooter. So while I don't think he's going to be, you know, a great shooter, I think he'll be able to shoot enough to get people to respect him as in a second unit, and he's just a fantastic passer, you know, great reads defensively. Off-ball defender, he's right up there with, I don't know, he's not as long as Lonzo, but like he has that same type of ability to, you know, read the playoff ball and get a ton of steals and really frustrate the opponent. And on ball, he's got pretty good lateral quickness. He's still got beat some just because, I mean, with the athletic ability of point guards league, you're going to get beat naturally. But I think he's actually, you know, a plus defender on ball, and off ball, I think he's fantastic.
I respectfully disagree with you on his shooting just because he's passed up so many shots. I mean, he really just does not look to take those at all. And 3.5 attempts per game is pretty low for a guy who's playing starter minutes in the G League. So I'll believe it when I see it with him getting better. But I do agree with much of what else you've said here. I also don't think he's quite as good on the ball as a penetration guy with his change of direction. But, you know, I think an interesting analog for him would be TJ McConnell. Caruso has more size than McConnell, more ability to guard larger players, not quite as shifty with the ball. To me, doesn't have that mid-range game that McConnell has, doesn't have the strength that McConnell has, but somewhat of a similar player. I mean, Thomas Satoransky is another guy who's, you know, a taller guy who, you know, has some passing ability, plays intensely. I agree with you on his defense. I've liked the way, in particular, that he just denies guys and makes it hard for them to get the ball. I mean, any player who's a young player on the Lakers is going to have more of a spotlight on him, but someone who I think it could be interesting. You know, my inclination is that he probably won't be good enough offensively to really be that solid of an option as a rotation player, but, you know, especially if the shot comes along a little bit, maybe he can get there, and that's exactly who you want to have as a two-way guy. And, you know, for what it's worth, OKC, their staff apparently believed that he could be an NBA player as well, so we'll see what ends up happening with him this summer. What about Ivica Zubac at age 20?
He's a guy I'm not really much of a fan of. I mean, he's got a great sense of where to position himself, you know, for teammates when they're driving to receive those dump off passes, those, you know, little side steps, and just being able to create those angles. I think that's an underrated skill that he's really good at. And he's also got good timing as a roll man, you know, good touch around the hoop. He's not going to get up and, you know, dunk a lot of, you know, shots in traffic. He's 69% at the rim, but he doesn't have any stretch to his game. No, you know, touch outside the paint. He's not comfortable at all ball, sliding his feet on the perimeter. I think his motor has run a little bit hot and cold. You know, it hasn't been, I think, as good as maybe his reputation precedes, just as a guy that gets a lot of baskets around the rim. And he doesn't offer, you know, much rim protection at all. So to me, just the inside scoring isn't enough for me to think that he's going to be a rotational guy out there.
Yeah, and he's not really a guy who can get up for alley-oops as well either. I mean, he's got good touch. I think the 15-foot jumper could come along in time, three-pointer, and maybe not. But I think the biggest problem is just that he's slow afoot defensively, doesn't really have the explosion to protect the rim, can't really get into position. Any kind of pick-and-roll coverage other than a drop is going to be a challenge for him. So I think he's someone who might get kept around as a third center. Maybe someone who, okay, we're going to bring him in ahead of the backup center and start him just so he, because the only guy he can match up with is the other team center. But I do think he's kind of more of a touch guy and a skill guy, but he's got to really be just like more of a beast to carve out a role with his athletic limitations. How about Thomas Bryant, who has barely played for the Lakers this year, but has been outstanding in the G League?
Yeah, he's 81% at the rim as of a couple weeks ago. I looked at this in the G League this season, which I thought had to be like a typo or something. 81%, you know, pretty ridiculous, especially for a guy that wasn't thought to have, like, you know, crazy athleticism as a center, but he's finding ways to finish down there, and he's averaging 20 a game, 7 rebounds, 2 assists, a block and a half a game in the G League, and he's 36% three-point shooter. And, you know, his big swing skill is, can he move his feet on the perimeter? Can he guard out in space at all? And I think that was the big question coming out of, you know, with him coming out in the draft. So I don't know if he's, you know, been able to really, you know, improve that as much in the G League. You know, obviously, I'm sure they have him out there a little bit. I think the South Bay likes to switch a lot, but he's not up against NBA caliber athletes, so it's really hard to get a gauge of, you know, if he's any better against NBA point guards in that respect. My guess is not, but I'd be pretty shocked if they don't bring him back next year on his non-guaranteed deal. He's, you know, a great bench locker room guy. He's had a great season in the G League, like I said, and he's also one of the most, you know, fun guys to watch on the bench celebrating. He's just crazy with his celebration, so he's a great bench and locker room guy, so I'd expect him to be back, but I don't know what to expect from long term, to be honest.
Also noteworthy is dropped 36.4% of his 184 three-pointers, that type was really small this year, so maybe, and he provided somewhat of a stretch element coming out of Indiana. Possible this summer that he could be a casualty of their quest for cap room, because if they release him, they'll get, you know, another like $400,000 or so between the minimum cap hold and what his salary would be. He could end up being in the same situation as David Nwaba, where he gets claimed somewhere. I mean, you'd imagine since he's played so well in the G League, he probably would, but that's only if they just have to squeeze out every few hundred thousand dollars of cap space, so it probably won't end up being an issue. And let's finish up here on, it's kind of a depressing note, with a guy that Danny and I both liked and were surprised that he signed for so little with the Lakers, Tyler Ennis, who had been a massive disappointment until that late season run with the Lakers a year ago, but he's just had a nightmare of a season.
Yeah, there's not really many positives to touch on. He's had a bad season, 45% true percentage on a really low usage. He's shooting 28% three and 49% at rim, and he doesn't really have the quickness or athleticism to really penetrate, you know, demand defensive attention that's going to open up all of his pass skills. He was a great passer coming out of college, and can't really exploit that if he's not creating the advantage, drawing, you know, guys to him, opening up those passes. And as a defender, I just don't think he's very good overall. I think he's a pretty smart player, but he's slow. He lacks size to guard two guards, the speed to guard point guards. You know, I just don't think he's affecting that.
Yeah, a little lesson about the dangers of small samples. 39%, 21 out of 54 last year from three, 10 out of 42, pretty similar number of attempts, 24%. I'm not sure that he's a better shooter last year than he was this year. It could just be the numbers matching up, although he has looked a little bit more hesitant to shoot it as the shots haven't gone in as much, but he's been out of the rotation even with all the injuries that they've had for most of the year. So certainly a disappointment for him, a guy that we thought maybe could mature into being a quality option as a backup point guard. All right, well, that will do it for today. Thanks so much for listening. Of course, we'll be back tomorrow. We're going to do the rest of the Pacific Division, including the Suns and Kings. Actually, only the Suns and Kings tomorrow. Maybe we'll get into a few more as well with this, and obviously if any news occurs, we will bring that to you as well. Maybe catch up on the playoff and tank races again real quickly. I know we did that massive breakdown last week, won't be quite at that level, but But thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to y'all tomorrow night. Till then, thanks again to Coca-Cola and Powerade for sponsoring today's program. Stock up on Coca-Cola, Coke Zero Sugar, Powerade, and my personal favorite, Powerade Zero. Drank a bunch of that when I went up on a ski trip at altitude. Gotta stay hydrated. Swing by Walmart before every round to pick up that stuff. Make sure your fridge isn't empty by halftime. NCAA March Madness isn't just one game, it's a whole tournament. Make sure you're ready. Refresh every round by heading to Walmart to pick up Coca-Cola, Coke Zero Sugar, and Powerade.